It is Saturday, November 21st, 2015. We're broadcasting from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is Independent Public Radio 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz and streaming live worldwide at KUSP.org. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the Geeks affiliated organizations. Hey, I'm Lyle Troxell, and today I have a little different Geek Speak. Normally we talk to geeks in-house. This time I went ahead and did some field recording. I've been meaning to talk with Julia Gadinsky and Jim Whitehead about their app, The Mobile Ranger, which is kind of a navigation app, storytelling app, which you use to explore the world. So I headed over to UCSC to chat with them. And you'll hear my conversation with Jim and Julia about Mobile Ranger in the second half of today's show. But while I'm at UCSC in my old haunts, at the building that I helped design, the Digital Arts Research Center, I run into Arnav, and he's at a conference about artificial intelligence.
The name of the conference is Artificial Intelligence for Interactive Digital Entertainment.
Arnav Jala is Associate Professor of Computational Media in the Baskin School of Engineering at UCSC. He's also affiliated with the Center for Games and Playable Media, and he's the Campus Director for Study Abroad. But before all of that, he was working on his PhD, and that's what we're going to talk about today. Where was that?
So I got my PhD from the North Carolina State University.
Okay, so when you were there, what was your thesis looking into?
So my thesis was looking into artificial intelligence that could reason about visual storytelling the way film directors and cinematographers do. And so the idea was, could you encode a set of rules in an algorithm that can then analyze story events and construct visualizations that could tell a compelling story?
To give context about what your thesis is about, it's important to understand kind of a rudimentary understanding of the art of cinematography. More specifically, frame composition. Frame composition represents what's in the shot. An example of this is the POV, or the point of view, a camera that looks like a walking person. That's what it's seeing. Used a lot in horror films because it has this idea of limiting the scope of what the person knows and therefore you feel for them. Cinematography composition is a major impact on how the thing feels. And there are a lot of examples of how the shot can affect the scene. How did you get inspired and look into these?
For getting inspiration of where the rules of cinematography come from in terms of what the effect of decisions of framing and point of view, camera positions have on the viewers, I looked at a lot of film work in film studies. Mm-hmm. And there's a branch of film studies that film studies people like David Bordwell and Edward Brannigan, who is actually UCSP, follow, which is sort of cognitive-based models of film studies. And one of the theories there that Edward Brannigan proposed was called disparities of knowledge. And so the idea is that you model the disparity between the viewer's knowledge about the world and the character's knowledge about the world.
Uh-huh.
So, and what you see is that when you look at the point of view of a character, you know what they know about mm-hmm. the world, and there is suspense about what you don't know about the world, and you know that the character also does not know.
Right.
If you look at a character in a frame, looking outside the frame, you as a viewer want to know what they are looking at.
So like a shot where the person's mostly in shot, but they're looking not at the camera or something in their hand that you can see, but actually off screen. And normally, typically, unless it's a suspense situation, the next shot you will see is what that person was looking at.
Exactly.
Right? So these rules of when you can do that. Another example of this is a character is walking on a journey, and you're kind of watching them walk along. And if they've entered frame to the left side of the frame. Stage right, but we won't go into that. On the left-hand side of the frame, and they walk through the frame, and they exit on the right. The next time they enter, they better come in from the left, or it gets disjarring. Now, of course, you can use that to storytell, right?
Yes, and actually, the algorithms that I developed were, what I used was a tripartite representation of narrative, which is common in narratology. which is the distinction between fabula, where there is representation of events of the story of the world, chusette, which is the selection of those events that are important for the story, and then discourse, which is the selection of viewpoints or in case of natural language storytelling, you know, syntax and sentence structures.
Can we do a really quick example of that? So I, Lyle, go to the store and buy a sandwich. When I leave the store, I run into my grandmother. She says hello. We plan a date for a future event, and then we say goodbye. That's the story. So where do those things break down?
Right. So the way the fabula is just a sequence of events that, you know, you went to the store, you met your grandma, you bought something, you went back home.
Okay.
Then at the chusette level, you say, okay, do we want to create suspense about something, right? So do we want to communicate, like, okay, we'll communicate that you went into the store, but we don't know what you got from there. Mm-hmm. In which case you see Lyle going into the store, and then you see Lyle come out.
With a brown paper sack.
With something in their hand. And then so you see it, but you don't see what's in it. So at that point, you know that.
And that suspense, what's that called? What do we describe?
Chusette. Okay. It comes from Russian narratologists.
Okay.
And then at the discourse level, you have to ensure that the focus of attention of the viewer is specific, explicitly on the thing that you want them to focus on, and they're not distracted. Okay. And so this is why film cinematographers use tricks like match cuts, so that the frame composition matches whenever.
What do you mean match cut? What is that?
A match cut is where, let's say, you see me holding the handle of the door, and then the next shot you see me walking in.
Okay, so the camera first is the outside. You grab the handle of the door. That's an established shot that there's an action about to happen. Then the next cut is inside the store and the door is opening. We know that was the same moment.
Right.
Okay. And what's that called?
Match cut.
So match cut
is when the composition of, even though there are two completely different shots, that the composition is such that your eyes match it.
Okay.
This
is one like really powerful in action sequence, for example. Yeah. You go to see a fist going towards a face, and the next shot you see the person kind of spinning. You know what happened. Yeah. You put it together. In fact, some theory goes that you actually connect more to it because you had to fill in that emptiness.
Exactly. Uh-huh. So it's the process of sort of taking the viewer through a continuous set of actions. And then having them fill in those gaps.
Okay. And is that the discourse part you were talking about?
That is the discourse part.
Okay. So the actual construction to then put the story together. Okay. So now we've got a rudimentary understanding of what different angles, the other perspectives of this. If you shoot low and aim up, you're empowering the character. If you shoot from above and aim down, you're taking power away from the character. And you can do a lot of stuff with regards to that. Now, this is all theoretical, of course, but a language of film has been produced over the years that's actually reality now, that we're all trained, just like we're trained to understand certain types of music paradigms, we're trained to understand certain types of cinematography paradigms. So whether the theory created what we feel or whether that always was the case and we feel that way no matter what, it doesn't matter because we're affected by film in this way now. Okay, so now we've got the basics of film cuts, then this idea of these different types of narrative that you're encapsulating in film. What did your thesis do from there? Let's go forward now.
Right, so what I started looking at was how to create an end-to-end system, an algorithm that can reason about, so given a set of events, it could select the events that were the most salient to tell the story in such a way that the story was both comprehensible to viewers and at the same time interesting to look at, which means that it followed the visual idioms that we are familiar with now, that come from beginning cinematography books. So
what was your source material? Because, of course, normally somebody decided to take all these shots and they videotaped them. They filmed them themselves, right? So you already make the decisions when you create it, but your system didn't rely on that. What was it? What was its source material?
So what I started out with was a set of stories that were in the Western genre.
Okay.
Then I took a game engine, Unreal Tournament game engine, where
open source game engine. Well, I don't know if it's open source, but you can build upon it.
Yeah, actually, the version I had was not.
Okay.
But it came with a nice scripting language called Unreal Script.
So let me just describe that real quick. When you see a first-person game, like a 3D rendered game, where normally the game is you're running around with a gun and you're shooting people, right? Because unfortunately, that's kind of the normal games, the public games. A lot of these games are built upon like three or four different platforms. One of those is Unreal. It's named after the first game that became popular on that platform called Unreal Tournament. And that system allows someone, without writing the entire thing from scratch, to actually create stories in that. That filming, though, taking a game engine, making characters, and then making a story and filming it is called machinima, and it's a valid art form of making cinema, but it's machinima instead because, of course, it's not people, but it's actually the game engine. Okay, so you take a Western-themed character, sprite kit set, if you will, that decorates the scene, the Unreal game engine, and a scripting system that allows you to tell story.
Yeah, so what I did was I created a camera algorithm within the game engine that evaluated the... So I created essentially a vocabulary or a set of behaviors for the camera. So
things like wide shot, POV, over the shoulder, exactly, things of that nature you could do with the camera.
So so you define geometric constraints, and it has to be modular, because when the camera system makes decisions, it makes decisions at the level of, I want a close-up shot of this character, because at this time, when the character is doing this action, they're important.
Mm-hmm.
And when the system decides to do that, there is a particular behavior in the engine that I've coded up that finds the character's location on the screen. And then,
or in the 3D world,
in the 3D world,
the
virtual camera in searches through the space of possible positions of the virtual camera in such a way that the score for that specific composition is maximized.
Okay, let's break that down for just a second. Can you give an example? So I'm going to open the store to buy my sandwich, but we don't necessarily know that. So we have that me walking towards a door in the story. And of course, in the story, you know that there's a moment of entering a scene. So there's a transition happening here. So your system goes, okay, that transition, we need to do an establishing shot, or did you not get to that level of granularity?
Right. So there, it always picked an establishing shot.
Okay. Establishing shot is a wide shot that kind of gives you the context of the scene. Not a close-up, not a point of view, but kind of like you see the character and the stuff in the room. So in this, you'd see like me on the street outside a door and walking towards the door. Of course, I'd actually be a computer-generated Western character. Okay. So that's establishing shot. Your system would know it needed to do an establishing shot. And then it would say, how can I frame the next shot to get something is successful.
Right.
But what was it looking for? What was the metric on what it should show?
So what it did was, it was a search algorithm that had that searched for multiple solutions. So it said, well, there one way in which I can expand, I can film this specific action in the story, open door, is to focus on the handle.
The contact point between
contact
two objects,
point.
Right? Yeah.
And so there would be one shot that was added to this possible future visualization. So it is a planning system, which
right.
means that it creates a plan before it executes it.
Planning systems are a general term for part of an artificial intelligence system where you have to set up the structure, the plan. A really perfect example of this is that chess playing systems are planning systems, that they go, let's go into the future, multiple paths, multiple plans, mm-hmm. see which one's the most likely for success, and that's the one it chooses. So right. you're building up I might do a close-up shot, I might do an internal shot, I might do a close-up on the character's face. Like, these are all different
right.
possible choices.
Right. Mm-hmm. So the library has operators or behaviors that specify all the different shots that can be taken for one character in that action. And then the planning algorithm it needs to be applied a heuristic. So if you...
What is a heuristic?
A heuristic is essentially like... is a function that lets you rank your possible plans. So in chess, you have 7 different moves you can do next. But when you expand out what your opponent does and then go down a few steps, you realize that you in the future, for one of your moves, there's a potential future state where you know you can win from there.
Right,
the chances of winning are higher. And so There is an evaluation function
okay.
that essentially ranks your next step based on your future predictions.
And kind of like, is this a win?
How likely is the win?
And so, right. What's a win for filming a scene? Let me back up one second. I'll let you answer that in just a second. But first, let me describe Machinima a little bit more. You've actually, in a game engine, normally, the thing that's amazing about a game engine is that it's kind of cinematographic, right? You can run around, you can see the space. Things look almost completely realistic, and they get better all the time. So that's kind of amazing. But the reason why it's different than like going to see an animated movie is that the animated movie, like Finding Nemo or one of those ones, you have the same type of tool sets, but the camera position is very much set and you render it. In fact, every single frame, 1/60th of a second, takes enough time where you can't play it back real time. In fact, it could take a few hours to render each frame. So in a game system like this, though, you have to have it real time. And that allows you to completely script that character Lyle walks up to the door, opens the door, goes through the door, goes to the counter, says something to the counter, gets a sandwich, walks out. All of that's very much scripted. But what's not scripted in your system, unlike a game engine, and so a game engine wouldn't be scripted like that, right? You'd control it. But instead, you kind of flipped it on the edge and you said, no, the characters will be completely scripted, but the camera angles will be chosen at random. And since the game engine really is just a rendering platform for a 3D scene, you can do that, which is amazing. Okay, what's a win for a storytelling algorithm? I know how to win chess, but I don't know how to win story.
Yeah, and that's actually a really good question because there is no one win condition, right? So if my intention was to communicate this through in the way that, you know, Tarantino would do it, I would pick a very different set of camera viewpoints and transitions that would be more in the style of Tarantino, right? Mm-hmm. But if you say I want to do it in a way a daytime soap,
right,
is filmed, and then you will have very different type of camera. So the idea is that the algorithm at this stage contains the ability to have all of these different solutions in the space, and then you as a user provide the heuristic function to say I prefer this heuristic over that, and
meaning
it helps you.
I want a Tintero sandwich ordering grandma scene versus I want a soap opera.
Exactly.
Okay, so you, I'm assuming, use this system to do something other than go, this is awesome, because the first thing would be, that's awesome. What did you do with your system in the graduate
paper? So what in the beginning, what we were interested in is that style is very hard to measure because aesthetic preferences vary with people. And what we wanted to do was to see how this kind of an algorithm that reasons about communication of visuals actually communicates something meaningful. And so what I looked at was comprehension. Like
narrative comprehension?
Like narrative comprehension. Okay. So if I have a story and I communicate that story to you through the visuals, then what is the interpretation of the story that you are getting, and how does it match with what I want to communicate?
You're listening to GeekSpeak on independent public radio, KUSP. I'm Lyle Troxell. I'm speaking with Arnav Jala about his PhD work regarding computational cinematography composition and how narrative understanding can be altered by the composition of the shot. Stay with us, won't you? This is GeekSpeak. I'm Lyle Troxell. Arnav Jala investigates and inspects visual narrative. There's a lot of discussion in the world about how narrative works, but his focus is on how visual aspects of narrative work, specifically in cinematography. How does shot composition actually affect a scene? To figure this out in his PhD work, he composed a whole bunch of different types of the same film in a Western style. So makes a whole bunch of films, then has people watch them, and see how much they comprehend about the real story, depending on the variations that he's introduced on the composition of the shots. You must have had people watch a lot of movies, a lot of Westerns.
Yes. I mean, I myself watched a lot of Western movies because I wanted to actually replicate Western conventions. But what I did was I created stories and varied them and then conducted a study where my other students and people that participated in my study, the subjects were shown different story variations, and then they were asked questions about their interpretations of the character and their motivations, of the procedures, the steps that the characters took in order to achieve certain goals. And
of course, you had already structured the script, so you knew exactly what the real story was to some
exactly.
degree. And so the answers to those questions, you could judge whether they got it right or not.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
So what we did was we said, if the story were represented as a graph where each node represents an event,
mm-hmm.
and then each other and other connected nodes in that graph represent events that were either directly...
Are you saying nodes?
Nodes in a graph.
Nodes
yes.
in a graph. Okay. I thought you were saying notes. Okay. So yeah. nodes in a graph.
Nodes
so
in a graph.
In these very specific nodes, like yeah. got sandwich would
yeah.
be one
got
of the
sandwich
nodes.
Got sandwich. And then, so is it, okay. So got sandwich. Now, open door. Was open door something that caused you getting a sandwich, or was open door something that was procedurally required in order for you to get a sandwich? And so there's a distinction between something that actually motivates the next action
mm-hmm.
versus something that needs to be done in order to complete the next action as a procedure, right?
Okay, so you took your engine, allowed you to render certain styles, different cinematographic styles. It's exactly the same story in the sense that we know that all that is scripted. They acted out exactly the same every single time. You ran through and generated a few different films based off of different styles, soap opera or Tarantino, or understanding that a moment is more tension-filled and therefore let's do a horror or a lot of different... what do you call it when you decide those rules? In the sense like a Tarantino film versus a soap opera versus a horror. What is that
a
called?
Heuristic,
right.
Yeah.
So you have different heuristics. You generate these films... Or I guess you could actually have them watch real time. You wouldn't have to really even record it. And then you had people watch these, and then you asked them what really happened in the story. Did you find that there was actually knowledge differentiation based off of style? Like, did the filming style change what people knew?
Yeah. So I was not looking at style in that sense of sort of Tarantino level style. What I ended up doing was that I looked at three different forms. So in user studies, in the scientific method, you usually have a control condition.
Uh-huh.
And so the control condition in this case was the master shot. So master shot is a shot that is set up by the director. It's a wide shot that sets up the orientation, the stage, and is often used by editors in situations where there isn't a good close-up shot
mm-hmm.
In the editing where there's a gap. The editors usually switch to the master shot.
Is a master shot kind of like an establishing shot in the sense that it has all the context you need to know what's happening?
Right.
Okay.
It is the establishing shot for the scene.
So the scene for this one might be like a wide shot of the street with a storefront in the center and me walking in from out of sight,
right.
going in the store. The next shot would be like from the side, a shot that would show the clerk behind the counter and me and the sandwich rack. And I pick up a sandwich and I put it. Like everything necessary was really clear. Okay, so that was your control cell.
That was the control, yeah. So every unique location or a stage had exactly one fixed camera position, and the camera did not move while the action was taking place within that setting.
Got it.
The other one is, the second condition was what was familiar to gamers, which was a view that the camera was always... behind view over the shoulder of the character as they were moving, so that you looked at all the actions that the characters did.
Okay, like a first-person shooter.
Like a first-person shooter.
Okay.
So in that case, then you knew exactly what the character knew. And if they didn't see their grandma on the side, then the camera wouldn't have seen it.
Okay.
And then I let my system automatically pick camera shots. And so I recorded the videos in all three conditions and then showed it to people. So I showed two different stories,
mm-hmm.
And each of my subjects watched one story in one type of visualization strategy and another story in a different one.
Cool.
And then what we did was we asked our subjects questions about a specific event, but we also gave them answers. And the answers were picked from several other events in the story to say, okay, why did Lyle buy food? And then, so one event would be because he opened the door.
I see.
So is that a good answer? How good of an answer is that?
Got it. So you get to rate the answers.
And what it does is it gives you a sense for, so when you reconstruct the graph, you can look at the rating and then put that much distance between the two points in the graph. And that gives you the graph model that's in a particular viewer's mind after they looked at this.
Yeah, right, sure.
And then you say you compare the two graphs and say, how different are the two graphs?
Right.
The one that I intended to communicate and what they actually
Right. And the reason that's important is that if I describe to you exactly what the story was, that doesn't mean that you received what I think.
Exactly.
So instead you kind of map it to what the knowledge they seem to have after the fact. Okay. So did you find that there was a difference in understanding based off the different styles or the different camera angles that were used?
Yes. So I asked them three types of questions. Why did event one happen? How did that happen?
Like, did he buy the sandwich because of the door?
Right.
Right.
And what enabled this particular event in the story? What was the specific enabling?
So the why, the how, and the what.
And the what.
Okay.
And what we found was that particularly questions about the character and their motivations, like why did Lane do this or steal from the bank? We found that there were statistically significant improvements in the version that where the camera was actively choosing shots compared to the control conditions.
So it produced more why they were doing it.
Yeah.
That was the one that got affected. The why of it was got affected by it.
And the how and what enabled. So what enabled was the one where there was least amount of difference, because what enabled was usually a direct connection between one event and the next.
Right, which is linear, and you didn't actually change the cuts in that
way. So. And the stories were fairly simple.
Right.
And linear. If there had been parallel events where certain events were actually hidden or communicated out of order, then we might see effects there. And this is something that we are working on as an extension.
Well, Arnav Jala, thank you so much for talking with me on GeekSpeak. Fantastic to hear about your research. I want to talk more with you, so we'll have to do it again.
Certainly.
Julia Gadinsky and Jim Whitehead, thank you for joining me on GeekSpeak.
Great.
Thanks for having us.
Pleasure to be here.
Now, Julia, I have followed your treks through Santa Cruz for quite a while. You've mostly been doing a blog for quite a while, writing about your passion, which I guess is history?
Actually, my passion is more landscapes. I have a lot of degrees in earth science, and I started out doing an app primarily, and it's turned into a blog so that I can get people to my app. It's really,
sort of
the evolution.
So yeah, I first saw of your writings from your blog, and then of course, the reason we're here on GeekSpeak today is to talk about the app that both of you created, the mobile, and it's also your name, Mobile Ranger, your pseudonym, I guess. Describe to me why you're doing this app. What was the reason to do this?
Basically, I created something that I would like to have myself. So like I said, I am an earth scientist, and I got into earth science because I like field trips. So when I go to a place, I want the story of the landscape that I see in front of me and how it got to be what it is. And it often intertwines with human history. So my personal focus is more the landscape history. But with Mobile Ranger, I've gotten a lot into the human history because people really like that. And the intersection of the two is really my favorite sort of sweet spot where I like to write about whenever I can.
The app is Mobile Ranger Guides. You definitely want to search for Mobile Ranger Guides on the Apple Store or on the Google Play Store. Go ahead and download it, and you'll see that most of the focus is around the Santa Cruz area, but the app is actually supports multiple storytelling in different areas. But let's just talk about one of these areas. When you say that you're interested in the landscape of the area, the lime kilns, we're currently at UCSC, so we might as well talk about the lime kilns, which are here. What do you mean by the landscape versus the human interaction that happened here? What interests you about the lime kilns here at UCSC?
Well, the lime kilns, the fact that they're even here, you have to go to the landscape to understand why they're here, because you have the karst topography and the limestone that's underneath them. So for me, I love the story of what happened with the oceans, you know, sea level changing, the deposition of these lime deposits in
the first
place.
What's the lime come from?
Calcium carbonate.
And where's that come from?
Seashells.
Seashells, cool. Yes. Ancient seashells, right?
Absolutely.
So we're actually dealing, the even though UCSC overlooks Santa Cruz, it's very much on the top of the Santa Cruz landscape. It is actually a deposit of deep ocean beds that have been pushed up because of our wonderful shape of California, if you will. So from a geological perspective, you're interested in that. And then because of that, what's happened with, I mean, for me, it's the human story is so much more interesting because you can talk about the ancient thing and the theory we have about how it moves up. But then you talk about what created Santa Cruz or what happened here. Much more interesting personally to me.
Right. Well, it's interesting to a lot of people. And so Mobile Ranger has become an intersection of both kinds of history, human history and natural history. So the story of Henry Cowell and lime production here in Santa Cruz is told in that particular tour within the Mobile Ranger app. And it's really quite interesting. San Francisco got a lot of its highest quality lime here from Santa Cruz for something like 50 to 100 years.
And so the posts, the application looks like a whole bunch of images of different areas. And we've just been talking about the lime kilns at UCSC, but you also have Westcliff Drive and San Lawrence Riverwalk and South Skyline Boulevard. These are all touristy kind of travel spots in some ways, especially if you know the area. And this app allows to be a guide with you when you travel and engage in the space. But it's more than that because it seems like it's really kind of a creative endeavor by a lot of people. I take, for the example, the Art Walk, which looks like the River Art Walk, looks like an installation piece that's guided where you can experience what was an art installation all the time via this kind of guided tour system.
Right. So actually what the app has become, I originally started out thinking I was going to be able to make apps that I wanted to and charge for downloads and people would pay me and it would be a great business model. What I found instead was that in making content for my first tour, which was Westcliff Drive, that there's tons of people with great content already out there. Mm-hmm. There's local museums and historians and naturalists. They've been living here and gathering photos and information for years and years.
Yeah.
And so what Mobile Ranger has become is a platform for basically any cool information that's natural history and human history related, including art. So we worked with the Arts Council of Santa Cruz County to put in their temporary art installation. Mm-hmm. A lot of those installations are gone, but you can still see what was there and the inspiration of the artists and what they were trying to achieve in terms of connecting people to the river still in our app.
Yeah. So you said you first, the idea was to make apps and sell them. This is actually a free download. Is that a temporary thing? How are you planning on subsidizing what you do? Or is this going to be from passion?
There's a lot of passion in it, but I do plan on having a business model that works and allows me to sustain it. Basically, I'm looking for nonprofit organizations that have a significant budget to be able to pay Mobile Ranger to get their message out there, get their history out there in tour form, and not just getting it into the app, but we also promote it with blogs and social media.
Right.
So we get it to a much wider audience than just would see it in the app.
So it's a marketing arm, a marketing company as well as an app development company, right?
It has become that. That was not my initial intention, but here I am.
So you launched this app, Mobile Ranger, last year, and I'm assuming, are you developing as well? Is Jim doing it or both of you doing it?
Jim is definitely doing the heavy development.
You're doing the programming?
Exactly. Yeah, I'm the tech guy.
And Jim, you're a professor at UCSC in computer science, computer engineering.
Actually, I'm now in our new computational media department. So computational media is this view on computer science where you're very technically focused, you care a lot about technical issues, but it's really focused on media uses of computing. So if you think about our uses of computers every day, we're using email, we're using Facebook, we're using Twitter. These are all forms of media that the computer made possible and just were not really, we were not able to do them without the computer being part of it.
So it sounds more like humanities to me than computer science.
There's certainly a heavy humanities and social science and arts element to it once you start dealing with media. Computational media, the department is really, our focus is mostly on the technical affordances. You know, how do you program this new kind of media? How do you add new capabilities to media? How do you create new forms of computational media?
Media, do you have sub-departments or anything or degrees that you're offering? And so you can kind of throw those out there so we know what we're talking about here.
Well, historically, we we've been really heavily focused on computer games as one particular kind of computational media. We will probably in a year have a master's and a PhD program in computational media. And we also have a games master's program over in Silicon Valley that's related to the undergraduate. But
app development.
App development. Yeah, with exactly. With Mobile Ranger. Yeah, so Mobile Ranger is a kind of computational media. Having this set of interactive tours all available inside your cell phone, either iOS or Android, and you're able to kind of download them, look at a large number of pictures, a large amount of text. If all the tours that were in the Mobile Ranger Guides app were printed out into a book, you'd be carrying around a book that was, 2 inches thick with all the photos and all the text that's in there. So
there's a ton of content in there. There's a lot of books like that, right? When you go and you look at travel books, there's a mass amount of travel books. At any good bookshop, you'll see shelves and shelves and multiple volumes of one city. But of course, you don't always have those with you. And this the world for world we're in, you almost always have your phone. So having that kind of access is pretty fantastic for that kind of, because I love travel books, right? I do not want to have heavy stuff with me when I travel. So they don't match well. So you took the content that Julia's been writing, and other people, actually, Julia, because you've been collecting a group of people to develop all this work, right?
Absolutely, yeah. There's a lot of authors of the content.
What's the process of turning that into an app?
Right. a couple steps. And one is just planning out, usually people don't have the content kind of put into neat pages worth of information. So the first step is even just thinking about, okay, what are the stops? What are the pages of information that you want to have in that app? Then there's the process of writing, collecting all the photos together. There's the typical issue of, who has the permissions to these photos? Oftentimes the photos are coming from this museum or that museum or this person's private collection. And so just dealing with photo permissions is a big issue too. But then there's the technical issue of getting that into an HTML format. So they're all web pages underneath the hood. And that's all these days on a remote web server so that we have the ability to update that information and then the app can go and grab the updated content and the updated images.
Oh, Jim, it sounds like we get to get geeky, which I love. But we'll do that in just a second. First, we're going to take a quick break. I'm speaking with Jim Whitehead and Julie Godinsky about the Mobile Ranger app. You can find out more information at mobileranger.com or by visiting the app stores and searching for Mobile Ranger Guides. I'm Lyle Troxell. We'll be right back here on KOSP. This is Geek Speak on Independent Public Radio, KOSP. I'm Lyle Troxell. I'm speaking with Julia Godinsky and Jim Whitehead about their Mobile Ranger app. And I'm talking to them at UCSC, my old haunts, where I was for years, at the DANM program, the Digital Arts and New Media MFA program, which is currently accepting applications for fall 2016. They graciously let me use one of their offices for us to have a conversation. Jim and I were just getting into the details of the tech of his project. So Jim, you're just describing how you get all your content ready and put it into HTML. What is the back end of the system? Are you using something like PHP?
And that's the one area where my tech skills will not seem so great. Yes, I am using PHP. PHP is working fine for this application. It's okay. I do know about Node, please.
that's wonderful because I just had this conversation with a friend of mine who's actually getting into looking at what kind of things the Community College of California can do to help people in the tech field and enter the tech field, especially people that are underrepresented in the tech field. And we were talking about this, and I was trying to talk about what Node was versus PHP, and she had said, oh yeah, PHP is never used. I'm like, no, it's probably really still massively popular. Facebook, of course, actually runs famously all on PHP, their own compiled engine. But it's not like these technologies are gone. They're all really strong. It just happens to be that Node and Python are really big right now. And I kind of feel, and maybe you have an idea of this from the focus on academia and computer sciences, that it's because they're kind of attractive and sexy more than they're better than the other ones. What do you think?
We could probably do a whole show on server-side technologies, but my sense on PHP is it's very mature. A lot of people know it. It also has really good scalability qualities now. Node, my sense of it is it has much, much better scalability characteristics. It's a little bit harder to program and get going than PHP. People are liking it because it's all in JavaScript, and so you have your web app, you know, your one language between your client side and your server side, and so people are liking that as well.
Okay, so this is a web app that you've made. Mobile Ranger is actually a web app, so it means that it's a native iOS app. And did you say you have an Android app?
It's actually not native. We decided to use Cordova, and then building. And so Cordova is this.
I always thought it was Cordova. Cordova? Whatever. Go on. Yeah. What is it?
I thought PhoneGap was a much better name, but there must have been some reason they moved away from that. And then we're building on top of that. So Cordova allows you to build a web app using normal web technology. So it's kind of like it's a web application, but it's running underneath the hood on mobile, and it runs just as well on Android as it does on iOS. And then I build on top of that. I'm using a framework called Angular, which is usually for making web applications, but it works well for making mobile applications. And then on top of that, there's something called Ionic, which provides me a set of user interface widgets. And so that provides the look and feel.
This is like the menu bar scrolling up from the left-hand side. You didn't actually code that. You're using a plugin, basically, or a module.
Yeah, absolutely.
So so that means the great thing about that is that you can actually compile for iOS and also for Android. Do you have an Android version of this app then?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, in fact, I developed it primarily for Android. That was the phone that I was doing it. And then it was really pretty magical. I just kind of checked it into GitHub, checked it out again, put it on iOS, and 5 minutes of futzing later, it's running on an iPhone. It was pretty amazing.
That's wonderful. That's really fantastic. That's wonderful. Promise of that space, a PhoneGap always kind of promise. Right. I think they moved away from PhoneGap for two different reasons. They have a core technology, which is open source, and that's the Cordova platform, and then there's also the company wrapping around that. And, of course, they run on any mobile device, right? So they also run on tablets. And so PhoneGap isn't the right term because it's also tablet gap. Anyway, that's my guess. So does that mean that you have to have an internet connection to use the app? Because some of these locations you've chosen, Julia, are not necessarily connected to the network.
Right.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And that was one of the key technical challenges in making the app. I had a couple scenarios. So one is you would download the app, you wouldn't start it up, and then you'd be offline the first time you started using it. So we wanted there to be at least one tour that would show up in that situation. So there's sort of one tour that ships natively with the app, and that one will start up in that scenario.
Okay, so what you're describing is when you actually download the application, you have network. If you do not run the application, whatever was on the app store, all that data is what you have. And if you then at that point, you might need to connect and get more stuff. The platform you described in the Cordova platform, or Cova, what do you call it? Anyway, allows you to do a web view, which means that it's kind of like a browser, so that after the app runs to get the content, it actually connects the network to your PHP web server and downloads this. So that problem space you were trying to solve, that you download it, then you travel out somewhere and you don't have anything, but you packed one of these in. But so now let's say you do install it and you run it, you install the app, and then you run it once in a good network environment. Do all the stories download at that point?
Right. Yeah, I decided to not have that happen because then it would be the first time you connect, all of a sudden you're downloading, 100 megabytes, 200 megabytes. Yeah. It would, you'd be like, whoa, what's going on here? So it's really pretty on demand, although it's even there a little tricky in that if you go into a particular tour, it'll go ahead and it'll grab all the HTML pages and it'll proactively grab those and store them on the local device. But it's only once you go to a particular page that'll then load all the photo content because the photos are so much more space and so much more bandwidth.
And the way a web page works is the actual app has no idea what image is used. The web page comes in, the HTML document, and then it calls for an image, and the browser actually kind of takes care of that for you. So there is a bit of that. I've noticed that because the images load in. Now, truth be told, I was kind of pushing it. I think everywhere this has good network because Santa Cruz has pretty amazing network. But some places you'll be in a situation where you won't have a network when you want to use this app. So you're caching the HTML to some degree.
Yeah, okay. Definitely.
All right, let's get back a little bit more to the app itself. What was, Julia, you're asking Jim to develop something for you from a coding perspective, but you have an idea of what you want to deliver. What was your, had-to-have-it kind of feature for this kind of application? What do you need right away?
To be honest, it's fairly low-tech, just a really nice picture. Here's where we are, and here's what we're looking at. A lot of people have said they have to have audio. So we had audio in the first rendition of the app, which was a native iOS app. And we found not a lot of people actually used it.
Yeah.
So is currently fairly low tech in terms of the features that we have in it. We'd like to get more audio and video in it moving forward.
But one of the things I loved about it is that I was talking about the line kilns last night when I was showing this app to my wife, and she's like, oh, Where at UCSD are they? I'm like, well, they're really... And so I open up your app and I'm showing it to her, and there's a map and all the points are targeted. For me, the map was essential. Like, that seemed like the crucial piece, right? Because a lot of these are not just one location, but it's kind of a tour or a walk of an area.
Right. Yeah. I think the map is an absolutely important feature too. Yeah. But, and I would like it so that we eventually have some kind of a notification if you happen to be near a stop, but that's something that's not currently...
Uh-huh. Okay. So Jim, you're not a full-time application developer, total sideline. You're doing it for Julia because she's asked you to do it. How's this relationship working on it? Is it okay doing this process, or would it be better if people were getting paid lots of money and, you know, you had tons of people working on it? I mean, what's the flow like right now?
Right. Good question. I guess I think the main challenge is, I think Julia would like new features to come into the app at a faster rate than I'm able to put them in there. On the other hand, kind of hiring someone to do the development, it's challenging. You either sort of get someone that is possible for a small company to afford, but then usually the code quality is not all that good.
Sure.
We had this experience making an Android version of a previous version of the app and using an outsourcing firm. And when I dived into the code, they had essentially like taken a previous app they had made and just like lightly customized it. And there was all this dead code in there from the previous app.
Yeah,
and
it was
kind of, from a technical perspective, it was really gross. And I was just like, and then I had to maintain this code that was kind of horrible and I didn't like it. And
so rebuilding it made sense. And choosing Angular is a good idea. I personally would have chosen React as the front end, but that's just because I have some more React experience. But Angular is a great, once you make your modules and stuff, it's really easy to continually build the app and hone it out. At this point, Julia, what's your next tackle for getting more content in here? Because you could theoretically, in a really busy week, maybe a week and a half, do all of these tours. They're currently an app. Are you adding them all the time, or what's the flow right now for new content?
So we just did a big push. We had an app launch party October 27th, and I got about 6 new tours out for that. There had been 10 tours in the app. So right now I'm trying to actually go for some more high quality tours, really focusing on the writing quality, mm-hmm. being really good and captivating to people. And I'm moving more towards trying to do a lot of the writing in-house, either myself or hiring some writers. Uh-huh. So it's got a more consistent voice and that consistent quality.
Sounds similar to a magazine or a journal, right? I mean, in the sense that you're going to continually write content with photos. So it's like a photojournalism kind of.
Kind of, yeah. And the focus is on, local history and local stories. And, ideally I'd like to sort of take over the world. And whenever you go somewhere, you want to know the story about the tree or that house or that building. Let's go to Mobile Ranger and see what that local story is.
Yeah.
And generally the source for the information is local sources.
What I love about this is that we keep on using the metaphors of travel books or a magazine, because of course this is a new form, right? This isn't the same form. And in the map embedded in it is an obvious example of that, right? You can't have that kind of where am I currently and where do I need to walk to next, that live updating kind of capability doesn't exist other places. So this new form of a way to connect with your world, especially since most of the time with our devices, we are disconnecting from the real world. This is something where it's an app and you're connecting with the real world. It feels really good to use. So,
yeah, and that's actually something I struggle with when I'm doing the writing for the content, uh-huh. is I want people to not just be staring at this thing, but actually to connect to a place. And how do you do the writing to do that? So I try to take the local picture and point stuff out and then say, okay, here's the feature. You can see this old river channel in the side of the hill. Look around, try to find some more, get your kids to find some.
Right. Kind of like a tour guide would be with you.
Yeah. Kind of like a live park ranger. I mean, I think the best park rangers tell good stories and they inspire you to ask questions and to think about where you are. And so that's really the goal with Mobile Ranger is to try to do that.
The app is Mobile Ranger. It's on Apple and Amazon Play Store, I guess. I mean, sorry, not Amazon Play Store, Google Play Store. So for your Android devices. And there are other things we didn't even talk about. Marine Life Guide, the phytoplankton stuff is amazing. The photographs about how phytoplankton and how the color of the ocean changes based off what's in it. I'm not going to go into it more, but you can, because it's really easy to get this app and take a look at it. And you're right now, are you looking for people outside of the Santa Cruz area to write stuff with you? And what does the publishing and writing side look like? Do you have to edit it? And does Jim have to hand touch everything? Or is there a CMS of some sort that allows you to manage it?
Yeah, so we are definitely trying to expand out of Santa Cruz. We're very Santa Cruz focused right now because we live here. But like I said, I'd like to go much more broad than Santa Cruz. And in getting this started, we've done a lot of back and forth writing with people. I find the easiest is either to have other people do all of it and trust that they're doing a really good job,
right,
or kind of to do all of it myself. The back and forth tends to be a little bit difficult. And when you give people specific directions on, you know, exactly the pixel sizes and stuff for pictures, they don't always happen exactly how you want. So we're kind of, I'm trying to go to this sort of either, you know, you go through some vetting process that you can handle the technical stuff and the editing and you give that all to me. And that would be a much less less costly package price than, or you give me the content, the sources, the photos, and we will make a beautiful package for you.
Nice. Yeah. Jim, do you want to add anything to that?
I guess to your question about the CMS, it's definitely something that we want to do. And right now there is a lot of hand editing and kind of, you know, manually FTPing things up to a server and so on. So yeah, it's still a little, high touch in terms of getting something up into the app.
Quick acronym catch up. CMS is content management system, like a WordPress website interface is kind of like that. And then you said FTP, which is file transfer protocol, of course. And you probably mean SFTP of some sort, I would assume.
Right, sure.
Good, yeah, secure right, in that sense.
Of course.
And the other thing I want to note is that you do not have to be at the location that this app is. You can use it from remote. In fact, last night I was laying in bed looking all about UCSD's lime kilns and reading up about it. So it's a great app even if you're not at the location.
Right. And that's kind of what Mobile Ranger has evolved to is it's an app for use on site, which was originally what I thought I was creating. But I have found that I have got a lot more interaction with people reading the stories online.
Yeah.
So really right now we're sort of leveraging the content for all forms.
Cool. Jim Whitehead, thank you so much for being here on GeekSpeak and talking about the tech side.
Absolutely. I love geeking out.
And Julia Godinsky, thank you so much for joining me. And thank you so much for being a historian to the town that I love.
Thank you. Thanks so much for the opportunity to be here.
You can find out more and actually download the free app, Mobile Ranger, at mobileranger.com. More information, photos and stuff. If you don't have a mobile device, you can actually go there and see a whole bunch of cool content, pictures and things like that. And, of course, contact Jim and Julia if you're interested in the project. And also, if you search on the App Store and also on the Google's search store, whatever, Mobile Ranger Guides is what you're looking for to see the cool content. And especially for those podcast listeners that don't know Santa Cruz area well, it's a cool way to learn about Santa Cruz as well. I'm Lyle Troxell. We have a few more minutes for this episode of GeekSpeak, so I figured I'd go ahead and tell you a little bit about an experience I had. Now, professionally, I'm a user interface engineer at Netflix, actually. I work on a few of the different devices. Specifically, I've been working for the last couple of years on the iOS devices at Netflix. And user interface engineer means that I program and I work on the interface that you use with the app. So if you use the Netflix application on iOS or iPhone or iPad device, you see my work. And recently, Apple released a new TV. So I'm in the UI space, user interface space, and I'm also, in video playback. And of course, the TV is exactly that. And I can kind of mean to talk about it on GeekSpeak, but it's a little strange because it does feel like a little commercial. I'll say that there's definitely some downsides on it. It's a really expensive device, much more expensive than other devices of its type. The Apple TV is not actually a television. It's a little tiny box. Other companies that make boxes like this, Roku makes one. Roku's is really quite good. Roku has a few different types of devices. The first time I ever saw Netflix on a television was through a Roku box. And these boxes, the Apple TV or the Roku box, also the Chromecast by Google, and I think the Fire Stick by Amazon, all of these things have a DVI port, or excuse me, an HDMI port, sometimes a DVI port, HDMI port, which is what TVs, current day TVs, use as their input. So you plug this port from the little box to the TV, and then the other end of the box either has a wired internet connection, Ethernet connection, or a Wi-Fi connection. And you set this thing up to use your Wi-Fi. And basically you get what you'd expect, streaming video from the internet on your television. A cool little box. And all of these boxes actually have features that are very similar. On the Roku, on the Apple TV, on the Chromecast, you can get Netflix on it. And the way you do that is different on all of them, but in general you can do that. You can get YouTube, you can get CBS, you can get BBC. And all these companies that are producing content or providing content stream their content out and have apps on these devices. So obviously, it's a cool way to connect to the internet, to be kind of a cord cutter or get rid of your cable, whatever. So the Apple TV is a refresh that all of us Apple geeks have been expecting for a long time, and it does have a couple really cool features. The remote is basically the coolest feature, search and remote. The remote control actually has a kind of a swiping back and forth gesture you use with your thumb. So it's like a touch surface, right? Kind of more like a touch surface on your computer than on your phone, and you can swipe to the right, back and forth, and all that, and that's how you navigate the system. And it feels really good to swipe this back and forth. I know that doesn't seem like a lot, but keep in mind that our current day interface is for a television. The real interface for television is a remote control. And I don't know anyone that really loves their remote control. So any kind of new investing and research into a different type of remote control excites me because it's a problem we obviously need to solve. The UI has also this kind of feeling like, normally on a television remote, maybe you haven't thought about this a lot, but as you're navigating around, like on a DVD, when you're selecting something and you push a button, you jump from one place to the next place. That's pretty much all we've got for navigation. There's also a pointer device. The LG TV series has a pointer device that actually shows a reticule on screen, like a mouse. Not the best way, in my opinion, to navigate a UI that's so far away, mostly because the movement across the screen is kind of can be minute and delicate, but you're doing it with your wrist across the room, a little difficult. But in any case, the touchpad on the Apple TV has they've done this thing where you can swipe it fast and skip lots of things all at once. Now the downside. Now I already mentioned the price, and keep in mind the Chromecast is 20% the price of the Apple TV, so a lot less. But the Chromecast, you actually have to use a different device to push content to it. Use your laptop or your phone, use one of the Google devices, and then you can say, I want this to go to my TV. So it then transfers the stuff over to the Chromecast and plays. Little different interface. It doesn't have a remote control, for example. But the other side that Apple did, the other downside beside the price, is that the keyboard interface is horrible. And you need a keyboard for a device like this because you need to log into your Google account to watch YouTube. You need to log into Netflix or Hulu to watch the content from those shows. So you have to type in your keyboard, and you got to use this little trackpad. Not a great implementation. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission, and GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, which means you can use their content any way you'd like, just let them know the geek said hi. This is Independent Public Radio 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz and streaming live worldwide at KUSP.org. To find out more about this or any episode of GeekSpeak, please visit us online at geekspeak.org. You can also email us. Hey, what do you think of today's episode? What do you think of any episode? You like the long format? You like the rant about some product? Please do let us know. Send us an email at geeks@geekspeak.org or contact us on Twitter and Facebook. We're KUSP Geeks. Our theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. I'm Lyle Troxell. This is the November 21st episode of GeekSpeak 2015. Thank you for listening.